The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. Does this sound okay? It's nice to be here. I wanted to begin this talk with a story about one of the great contemporary Vipassana teachers. She's not living anymore. Her name was Dipa Ma. And she was from India. And she was one of the important teachers to Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and that generation of teachers. And she was said to be a very powerful practitioner, a powerful presence. She had done most of her meditation training in Burma and then returned to Calcutta, where she lived in a small apartment, and she met students, she met Westerners who came to study with her and learn meditation from her. So this story is when she was already probably in her 60s, so quite, not so young. And she came to IMS, which is a meditation center in Massachusetts, to lead a three-month retreat. And, these three-month retreats are in the winter, usually from October to December. And it was, if you've ever spent a winter in the kind of western Massachusetts, it's pretty cold. It's like, it can be snowy. Last time I was there was a big ice storm. Very beautiful, but very cold. And so Dipa Ma was leading this three-month retreat, and she had the habit of, on all the breaks, she would do her walking meditation. So she'd go out in the front, the road, and be walking back and forth in the cold. So she co-led this retreat with American teachers, American Vipassana teachers, and one of the teachers, thought, here's Dipa Ma, she's from India, she's a kind of older woman, she's out there every day in the snow, doing slow walking back and forth. So she said, "What can I do for her?" So she found a pair of really warm, cozy wool socks, and she presented them to the teacher, to Dipa Ma, and everyone was happy to do that. And she was particularly delighted to see Dipa Ma using them, wearing these socks. Just so great. She could do something for this wonderful teacher. So at the end of the retreat, Dipa Ma went back to India, and she packed up all her stuff and she left. And this teacher went into the cottage where Dipa Ma was staying. And on the bed, there was only one thing in the cottage. So on the bed were these pair of socks that were kind of folded up and, placed on the bed. And the teacher thought, why didn't she take the socks? She doesn't like the socks. And, it was a little bit crestfallen, a little bit heartbroken, until she realized that she didn't make it clear to Dipa Ma that this was a gift, that this was, this was for you, and this is, please accept this, and please keep this. And, Dipa Ma was practicing the precept of not to take what's not given. Not to take what's not given. So, I don't know why I remember that story, but, something about it was moving to me. It's like, something about the kind of precision, sensitivity, or thoroughness that is possible to bring to the precepts, or to kind of to ethics, you know, to moving through the world in an ethical way. I just thought that was, you know, just remembered that story. And, you know, I'm sure you've had experiences like this, but something about to encounter someone who has a very strong ethical core, who has a profound sense of living in an ethical way, a highly developed ethical practice. There's a kind of goodness that emanates from the person. It's a, you know, it's awesome. It's just this, just kind of like, whoa. And so tonight, I would like to talk a little bit about ethics and the role it plays in this practice. The Buddhist word sila is usually translated as ethics or virtue. I don't know about you, but for me, when I hear those words, you know, especially in a religious context, it makes me think of something like, you know, commandments, or, you know, the Ten Commandments, or rules, kind of, you know, rules, or, you know, good and bad, good and evil, something that's very certain, and maybe even, you know, there's an element, you know, just that my association is kind of a judgment, or moralism, moralistic. So the first point I would like to make is that in this context, or in the Dharma context, the Buddhist context, there's a very different understanding of ethics. You know, it's like the Buddha centered his teaching around two things, you know, understanding suffering and ending suffering. You know, and he said that, you know, all of my teaching, everything that he taught was for the purpose of those two things. So in that framework, it kind of frames what I think is the key question in terms of ethics in Buddhist practice, which is, does this action lead to suffering? Or does this action lead to freedom, to ending, alleviating suffering? You know, it's like, will this action promote clarity? Will it promote calmness? Does it bring us closer to freedom, or or not? Or, you know, is it something? So sometimes it's framed in the skillful or not skillful, or conducive or not conducive, you know, to this goal of ending suffering. So for me, I think in contrast to the kind of this abstraction of unchanging rules of behavior, this sense of ethics is very situational, it's contextual, and it's pragmatic, and it's kind of more along the flavor of having a personal inquiry, a personal exploration, and so for me, that makes the topic of ethics much more interesting. You know, it's like, it's something that's co-created, it's something that's living. So I think of sila, of ethics, in its broadest sense, is about how we relate, you know, how we relate to other people, how we are in the world, you know, how we line up with what's true, align with what's true. Traditionally, Buddhist practice addresses three questions. How should I act? What do I do? And what do I know? And those correspond to these three areas of practice, which is sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila being ethics, samadhi is meditation or concentration, and panya is insight. The word sila, the etymology, is said to mean bed, you know. And so some people have said, you know, this kind of like, it's kind of the bedrock or the foundation of our practice. And I think this is the traditional understanding that we get from Asia, that there's kind of this sequential, you know, first you get your ethics in order, and then you're ready to meditate. Then you meditate, and then you have insight. The insight arises. There's nothing wrong with that understanding. I think in a way, I would like to raise the question of, I don't think it necessarily goes in that order. And especially here in the West, you know, in Asia, it's very common and traditional to start with sila. You know, you start with ethics. And here in the West, most of us, I know for me, I didn't come to meditation practice because I was very interested in ethics. But something about coming in through the gateway of meditation, and developing that side of practice, it turns out that it's really connected to ethics. It turns out it's really connected to insight. And so I think there are a number of ways to come into the practice. I think as meditation deepens, you know, we become more sensitive. And this inevitably opens us in a way to a kind of an ethical dimension that, you know, we might not have been interested in at all. I mean, I remember, especially after having done a few longer retreats, you know, feeling like I was sort of changed against my will. You know, I wanted to do things, but I just, you know, I just couldn't. So it's one of the principles of the Dharma is that sila, samadhi, and panya can't really be separated. You know, they're not really different things. They're different words. Maybe they're different words for the same thing. And each is a door into the practice. So usually the instructions for ethics that are given to lay people begin with teachings on generosity, which is called dana, and then on the five precepts. This is from the Buddha. There are these five gifts, five great gifts: original, long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated, from the beginning, that are not open to suspicion, will never be open to suspicion, and are not faulted by knowledgeable contemplatives and priests. Which five? Abstaining from killing, abstaining from taking what is not given, abstaining from sexual misconduct, abstaining from lying, and abstaining from the use of intoxicants. In doing so, one gives freedom from danger, freedom from animosity, freedom from oppression to limitless number of beings. Yeah, so, isn't that nice? These five precepts, the Buddha calls them these five gifts, the kind of a precious gift that we can give to others and that we give to ourselves. One of the main aspects of this gift is a gift of safety. It's like when we live in accordance with the truth, when we live in accordance with the precepts, other people can feel safe when they're with us. We're not going to harm them, we're not going to steal from them, or lie to them, or harm them with our sexuality. It's giving this gift of safety to someone. They don't have to be afraid when they're with us. And sometimes this is called giving the gift of fearlessness. And it's said that this doesn't just benefit others, we also benefit. We kind of share in this safety and in this fearlessness. And we're protected. Sometimes the precepts, these five precepts, are called the five protections. It's like we're protected in a way from the consequences of unskillful actions. Worry, regret, sometimes feelings of guilt or shame. Those kind of complications. So in a way, living in accord with these precepts, what we gain is a kind of simplicity, a kind of lightness. One of the big problems with lying is you have to remember all your lies. It's like keep everything straight, and something about that, the kind of the simplicity. It's said that when we really see these benefits from living in this way, what arises is joy, a sense of joy, a sense of well-being. It's like, in a way there's this positive feedback loop. When we live ethically, we have joy, and we can reflect on ourselves and our lives and our actions and have this sense of joy, have a sense of well-being, the sense of contentment. In turn, that sense of happiness, that contentment, allows and supports further ethical behavior. I know for myself, when I act, against, or over the line, breaking some precept or staining a precept, as they say, it often comes out of a sense of discontent or a sense of, I'm not connected to something. Not connected to that joy. So joy, well-being, is said to be an essential part of the practice of sila, practice of ethics. So one of the major insights in this practice is understanding the connection between how we act and suffering, how suffering arises. And so it's like, what keeps us suffering is our clinging, is our attachment, our resistance. And in a way, we can use the precepts as a kind of a tool. In a way, I think about it as like a mirror, you know, that shows us our mind. It's like, it shows us precisely where our clinging is, you know, especially if, you know, we're about to cross a line, about to maybe, you know, break a precept. It's a warning signal, you know. We can use the precepts as a warning signal to say, hey, you know, hang on a second, you know, and you kind of check in and check, you know, check our mind state. You know, connect inside to what's happening. You know, so something about using the precepts as a tool that helps us to look internally. You know, and sometimes it may be that after we've checked in, it's like, you know, we've looked and we've reflected, the appropriate action is to go ahead and do what we were going to do, even if that seems like it's breaking a precept. This is an extreme example, but I don't know, it's on my mind. I was reading about this woman today, a Dutch woman named Jachi Vos, who during World War II, she and her husband hid a number of Jews in their house. And they were kind of worked with a number of other people to do this. And I was just reading this, you know, article, and it's kind of on the topic of ethics. It got me interested in this. And then this was the line I read in the article. Every time the Gestapo came, Mrs. Vos said, I would take questions from them and lie and lie and lie. and, you know, so it wasn't like, you know, well, can't tell a lie. You know, there were Jews here. You know, something about, you know, sometimes adhering to the letter of the precept is breaking the spirit of the precept. And I think the spirit of these five precepts and of Buddhist ethics in general is the spirit of non-harming. So these five precepts are pretty juicy areas of our life, of our humanity. You know, the life and death and sex and truth and money and, you know, power and all these things. So something about not cutting this part out of us, but learning to skillfully relate to it. The first precept, to refrain from harming living beings. Sometimes this is translated as not killing. You know, most of us, I think, probably, you know, aren't killing other people, and, you know, that's not a main issue. But, you know, maybe where this becomes interesting is how we relate to other forms of life, you know, the mice, the ants, the cockroaches, is one example. And when I was thinking about this precept, I was remembering when I was, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years old, my apartment had a lot of ants and other bugs, and I thought nothing of kind of, you know, hunting them down and kind of squashing them. And my best friend at the time, David, I remember watching him one time picking up an insect and, you know, very carefully taking the insect outside and, you know, releasing him. And you know, so something about that, it was very moving to me. And I realized that there was another way to relate to these kind of unwanted creatures. And I'm sure I couldn't have articulated this to myself then, but I think the reason I acted so strongly against them, it was coming out of fear in me. And something about, you know, something about learning to relate to these creatures in a different way. I didn't need to be so strong about it. And there were other ways of handling it. And it's a question. It's like, I think this precept it invites us to take a look at how we relate to all different forms of life. And sometimes the appropriate thing will be to take action. Whether it's acting in self-defense. I don't know if this is a good example, but, you know, taking antibiotics, which I guess is, you know, killing a bacteria or something. So something about that, the exploration, the investigation, being sensitive to that. To refrain from taking what's not given. They already talked about this example from Deepa Ma, and you know, my guess is that she has kind of a monastic understanding of this. You know, monks have quite a high standard of how to deal with possessions. And this precept, I think, is a higher standard than just not stealing. You know, it's like not to take something that's not given, that's not offered. And I know for me, it's like, you know, when I have an inner sense of contentment or an inner sense of abundance, something like that, the impulse to take diminishes. When I have this inner discontent or kind of, what do they call it? The opposite of abundance is like a scarcity or something. You know, it's like there's only enough to go around. You've got it, and I want it, and you know, even if it's just the last piece of pie, or whatever, you know, it's like, then that impulse can arise. So when this inner sense of abundance is mature, it's like we're not taking anything as mine, and I'm reminded of the Suzuki Roshi story where he holds up his glasses and says, you know, these eyeglasses aren't mine. They're yours. They belong to you. And you know, you just let me borrow them. You just let me use them or something. When a community or a culture is practicing this precept of taking what's not given, it can bring a tremendous sense of ease. Reflecting on this, I remembered how when I lived at Tassajara, which is a small Zen community in the mountains near Big Sur, there's such a tremendous, you know, sense of ease with your possessions. There's no locks on the doors. You can leave something somewhere and you know, an hour later, a day later, a week later, it will just be right where you left it. It's just very nice to live that way. There's something, defenses I didn't even know I had could relax. And I noticed this a little bit in Japan. You know, I spent some time in Japan, and it's definitely compared to the West, it's still extremely safe in terms of things like crime. And I'm always amazed that even in a huge city with 20 million people like Tokyo, at the Starbucks in Tokyo, you know, I'll watch a woman come in and she puts her purse down and her laptop down at a table and then goes all the way over, you know, and stands in a long line and orders her drink and stuff and then goes back. It's like, and I think, don't do that in New York. Don't do that in San Francisco. So something about that, so, you know, it's just nice. It's just really nice. The third precept, to refrain from harming with sexuality, with sexual energy. This is a big area. you know, in dealing with this natural energy. I do think it's interesting that it says the standard here is harm. So it's not, you know, it's not imposing any particular view about sexuality, but it's like, is this behavior harming? It's harming oneself or harming others? I've heard it said that the power of sexuality is such a powerful energy that if there were another force in the mind that were as powerful, no one would ever be able to get enlightened because it's so strong. So something about bringing mindfulness and bringing investigation and care into this realm, you know, how to use this energy appropriately. I think judging by the number of scandals that have happened periodically from religious figures, religious teachers, even Buddhist teachers, to do with sexuality, it's a big area. It's a big area. And I think there, and I'm going to say more about this, but something about, you know, when that energy or when those needs are in the shadows and unrecognized and not acknowledged, you know, then they have the potential to erupt in other ways. So I think mindfulness, meditation, you know, can play a big role in helping us with this energy, this precept. Precept number 4 is to refrain from false speech. Sometimes this precept is considered or is called the most important one because it said that if someone keeps this precept, the chances are you'll keep all the others. Because something about it, in order to break the others, you have to break this one. You know, it's like, I didn't take that. You know, it's like, you go, you know, it's two. Yeah. So, and it's said that the Buddha, in all of his lifetimes, before becoming the Buddha, broke, you know, all of the precepts, except for this one, except for lying, false speech. You know, it's like one definition of mindfulness, of this practice, is being honest about what's happening in the moment. So honesty and truthfulness is so important to this practice. And I would say it's especially important to be honest to oneself, to not to lie to oneself in this practice. And so I think something about false speech is like rejecting truth or rejecting reality. And it's complicated. It's, you know, we have a number of motivations. You know, I think for myself about, you know, these kind of so-called white lies. And for me, I try to make a practice of checking my own motivations. You know, often I'll think, well, I can tell this white lie because it's to kind of, it's to protect someone else's feelings, for example. And that may be true. But when I dig deeper, it's often more about protecting me, or protecting me from a conflict, or protecting me from something uncomfortable or something. So something about checking the motivations, you know, why do I feel the need to cover over the truth? Or why do I feel the need to embellish something, you know? And I think, again, this principle of non-harming, you know, lying to save someone's life is pretty different than lying to kind of make myself look a little bit better. Or, you know, have someone not be as angry with me. Something. The fifth precept, to refrain from intoxicating body and mind. So different communities interpret this, different Buddhist communities interpret this precept a little bit differently. Sometimes it's interpreted as completely abstaining from all intoxicants, like alcohol or drugs. Sometimes it's interpreted as taking a little bit of alcohol, for example, is okay, but not taking it to the point of intoxication. You know, so those are two different interpretations. I think traditionally, the precept is about full abstaining. You know, and again, the main principle here is that when we're intoxicated, you know, when we're drunk, for example, it's difficult to see clearly. It's difficult to see clearly, and we're more likely to break the other precepts when we're disconnected in that way, when we're not fully present. You know, some kind of clarity is obscured. And then it can also be helpful to have a wide sense of what's intoxicating, you know, especially if alcohol or drugs are not a big issue. Money can be intoxicating, television can be intoxicating, internet can be intoxicating, you know, even Buddhism, having ideas about that can obscure, our clarity. And so these are the five precepts, the five, five so-called gifts. And it's so connected with meditation, with the meditation practice, that I know of teachers who, when a student's meditation is not progressing, they'll often suggest, you know, to check your sila, check your ethics. You know? And is there somewhere that something that can be refined, something that can be looked at? And in a way, that can open up the meditation in a new way. So talking about the role of ethics in this practice, talking about the benefits of living ethically. And I think we know this. You know, I think many of us know this. And yet, for those of us who are not, you know, fully enlightened beings, we still do have delusion in our minds. We still do misperceive. You know, we misperceive reality. We act in conditioned ways. We act out of habit. Ways that can be unskillful, that can harm others. And I think this is a little bit about what I said before about the precept with sexuality. It's like when our own desires and when our own needs, our own longings are unrecognized, disowned or split off, somehow unmet, unacknowledged, this is, you know, when they're fundamentally unseen, this is when they kind of have the power to erupt. In potentially destructive ways. So I guess what I want to say is there's something about wholeness here, about this practice is not about trying to take a scalpel and cut out the parts of ourselves that we think are bad or not ethical or something. You know, and for some of us, it's not a scalpel. It's more like a sledgehammer or something, you know. And so something about bringing mindfulness and including all of these things, including all the sides of ourselves. Now, meditation, mindfulness is a very, very safe place to experience all sides of ourselves and to be open to all states that arise, that can come through. So something about that. We can reduce the fragmentation, that we can reduce the sense of inner conflict. It's like when we acknowledge, when we bear witness to our own vulnerabilities. And so something about the mindfulness practice as building a capacity, to hold everything, to include everything. I think that that's where transformation happens, including ethical transformation. It's not about kind of fitting ourselves into a box, but it's it's kind of the box becomes as big as the universe or something. Something can be held. You hold it all. And then along with this, something about taking an interest in this topic, taking an interest in how we act. And I see it as in a way, fundamentally, as a form of self-respect. It's like what we do matters. Our choices matter. And we're worthy of attention, and we're here to kind of accompany ourselves and bear witness to ourselves. So as the practice deepens, our capacity to be with our experience grows. Concentration and insight develop. And I think a quality that emerges that is kind of almost an inevitable byproduct of this process is compassion. Compassion for our own suffering, compassion for others. It's like we become more sensitive to how we can harm people and how we can harm ourselves. I know for me, my interest in ethics comes out of, I think it comes out of a sense of compassion more than anything. It's like, I don't want to cause harm. And almost in this way, these precepts transform from a prescription or proscription into more something like a description. They're a description of what it's like to live with a heart that is open and empty and sensitive. There was a Zen master named Yunmen, and he was once asked, what is the teaching of the Buddha's entire lifetime? He said, what is the totality of the Buddha's teaching? And Yunmen answered, an appropriate response. So even though ethics is kind of the foundation of our practice, the beginning of the practice, it's also, the beautiful result of a lifetime or lifetimes of practice. This is what it culminates to. All of the Buddha's teaching culminating into an appropriate response. And I like to finish by just returning to this this idea of people who, who we may consider heroes, people who take extraordinary personal risk to follow their own conscience and kind of to live ethically, often forcefully deny that they're heroes. They'll say, I am not a hero. I didn't do anything unusual. I just did, what had to be done. I just did the natural thing. I think of the guy, this was a few years ago, who who jumped onto the subway tracks and picked up, you know, and saved someone, you know, who had fallen. And he said, "I just, you know, I didn't think. I just did what was appropriate." Mr. and Mrs. Vos, these are the Dutch. The Dutch people in World War II. Mr. and Mrs. Vos resisted the notion that they had done something out of the ordinary. Interviewed for the 1992 book Rescuers, Portraits of Moral Courage in the Holocaust, Mrs. Vos said, "I want to say right away that the word hero is terribly misplaced. I don't feel righteous," said Mrs. Vos, who, like her husband, was a member of the Dutch Reformed Church. "And we are certainly not heroes, because we didn't sit at the table when all this misery started and say, okay, now we're going to risk our lives to save some people." You know, like just an appropriate response. There's something about, can we allow and celebrate those moments when our natural response naturally is appropriate, is an appropriate response. And you know, and find some joy in that the kind of everyday heroism. Okay, thank you very much. Now, if anyone, we have a few minutes. If anyone would like to say something or comment or question, or please feel free.
Is it on? Yeah. I've been studying Eastern philosophy, psychology for about 40 years now. And I guess the problem I have with it, among other things, is that all the language sounds good, but what does it really mean to have an appropriate response? Or what does it mean not to do harm? Because ultimately, these are all ideas, abstract ideas, but how does it relate to the real world that I live in? Because no matter what I do, somebody can interpret it any way they want. They can see it as a they can love it or they can hate what I do. So that's the problem that I have with so much of the Buddhistic philosophy, is it's very abstract, and yet it really doesn't say, get down to, I think, how you live in terms of real situations.
Oh, that's interesting. I think it is abstract, and when it's just in the realm of ideas, and the purpose of the teaching is to put it into practice, and it's kind of like that's where it becomes alive, and that's where, you know, if you're looking for kind of 1,000 rules, and if you just follow those rules, you know, walk this way, do this, say this, don't say this, and then, you know, it's done. I'm skeptical as to whether that works, you know, just personally. I think so for example, you know, what does it mean not to harm? Yeah, it's a great question. And it's not a question that has an answer in the abstract. But in specific situations, there is an answer, you know. There is a difference between harming, you know, there's a difference between killing and not killing and cherishing life. There's a difference between harming with sexuality, you know, versus something about respect, about intimacy. You know, in the specifics of our life, it's real. And you know, I don't know if this is what you're getting at, but I think there is ambiguity as well, and it's like you know, that's the exploration, I think. I don't know if someone else, you know, has thoughts on this.
What I'd like to do is, in your question, exploration, it occurred to me that what you get to do is you get to look at your intentions and the intentions behind one's actions, whether they're in speech or actions. Also, you get to look at the things that motivate you, your desires, your hindrances. You're probably familiar with the hindrances if you've been looking at Buddhism for a little bit. And you see how you meet your experience. Do you have control how another person is going to necessarily interpret your actions or words? Not necessarily, but you can take care in how you present them. And by understanding your motivations, etc., you mitigate, if not alleviate, harm that may or may not be have any currency for you or, you know, for one's practice. But as one's practice kind of gains momentum, one tends to look at those things as kind of weather vanes, at least I do, as to how things are, how I'm relating to myself, I'm relating to the world around. You know, I liked what Max said. It's sort of a sense of, I forget exactly, it's not, it's sort of a notion of self-respect that comes into the notion of sila. Not only are you respecting others, but you're really respecting yourself in how you comport yourself with the world around you. So it's, for me, it's a great kind of adventure, exploration. How do you meet your experience? How did I blow it this time? how did I screw up it again? Or, you know, it's you get to re-experience whatever until you get it, and then you get to move on to other things. But it's the lessons seem to come in circular patterns until you start recognizing how you're contributing to either your suffering or not suffering. And it's I don't know. What I like about this practice is that it's all experiential based. There's guidelines. It's like, you know, try this. It might work. It might not. It tends to work some people, you know, not others, whatever. But it's purely voluntary. It's take it or leave it. And if it works, it works. And if it doesn't, there's Calvinism. There's Catholicism, Judaism, isms. There's lots to choose from. Nihilism.
So I wanted to express gratitude, really, for the precept about not taking what is not freely given, and the way that's phrased. It's not stealing, and it is broader, and it's for me relates very directly to the way I relate to other people. So it came to me at a time when I was letting go of the little ways that I have of trying to get people to admire me or express affection or acceptance. And I just had a clarity about how by doing these things, I was trying to take what wasn't freely given. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I started becoming aware of what was freely offered, all these things that I was trying to get from people, and usually trying to get in abundance from a single person. I started to find in small amounts all over with everybody. And so I have a much greater sense of abundance because of that, and a lot less of that sticky feeling in my relationships with other people.
Beautiful.
And so that was a very, just the phrasing of that has really been a beautiful thing in my life.
Beautiful. Thank you. Maybe we should probably finish. Okay. Thank you.